Police and prosecutors, plus the timeline of when and why Florida closed down to fight the coronavirus. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Police brutality and racial justice are at the heart of protests that continue in South Florida. They're also at the center of the race to be Miami-Dade's top prosecutor. The state attorney, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, has had that job for almost three decades. Former prosecutor Melba Pearson is challenging her.
The opponent has never charged a police officer for an on-duty killing. And again, in 27 years, that is a miscarriage of justice, and that has to change.
Miami-Dade state attorney candidate Melba Pearson will join us this hour. Also, the role of police unions in reform efforts. Your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the B-Man. Bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and for supporting public radio. Protesters and advocates are calling for major reforms of the criminal justice system. They want to change how law enforcement shootings and killings are dealt with in the courts. Now, all this comes in response, most recently, to the deaths of several black Americans by police. Most recently, of course, in the last month or so, George Floyd in Minnesota, and earlier this year, Breonna Taylor in Kentucky. Now, here in South Florida, some activists have rallied against the Miami-Dade state attorney, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. They've criticized her for her record of rarely bringing forth charges on law enforcement officers involved in non-fatal shootings. She's never charged an officer for an on-duty killing. Here's Rundle on the Florida Roundup last Friday.
Prosecute police. We don't like to because most of them are good and honorable, but you know what? When they cross the line, when they break the trust with the people and they commit a crime, we do prosecute them.
Rundle is up for re-election this year. She's running against another Democrat in the August primary, Melba Pearson. Pearson is a former Miami-Dade County prosecutor and former deputy director of the Miami ACLU. She joins us now here live via FaceTime audio on this Friday on the South Florida Roundup. Melba, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
We want to invite the public and our listeners here to ask questions, make some comments. What questions do you have about prosecuting police shootings in Miami-Dade County or in any other jurisdiction? What do you want to ask a candidate running for the top prosecutorial job in the most populous county in Florida? Your phone calls live, 800-743-WLRN on this Friday afternoon, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at Florida Roundup. So, Melba, what changes would you make in how the state attorney's office in Miami-Dade County investigates police on-duty shootings?
So I would make a number of changes when it comes to the issue of police accountability and police shootings. One of the most notable changes I will make is the creation of a civil rights unit with dedicated prosecutors who will spend all of their time focused on police shootings and police misconduct cases. It's a travesty of justice that within 27 years that the incumbent has been in office, not one police officer has been charged for the killing, the on-duty killing of a civilian. And it's not that we've had a shortage of such cases. So there has to be the wherewithal, the political will to be able to do what is right and to be able to bring closure to these families who are grieving and have no other redress within the criminal system if the state attorney falls down on the job.
So are you saying that in those cases, you think there were legal grounds for charges, but not the political will?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you look at the case, for instance, of Darren Rainey, who was an African-American inmate here at a facility in South Florida, he was left in a shower to basically boil to death by four corrections officers, and not one of them ever faced any criminal accountability. There were definitely some challenges because of the fact that it's within the prison system, and there was this perception that the witnesses who would be other people in custody would not be believed, but that does not erase the fact that a horrible crime occurred and that a man was left to boil to death in a 180-degree shower. So this shows the community, this is a sign to the community that certain lives matter more than others. And that is completely unacceptable, and that is not justice.
You worked in the Dade County prosecutor's office for 15 years with the current SAO, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. Did you work on police on duty shooting cases?
I did. And it was quite interesting that when I started working on those cases, there were folks senior to me who was like, when I brought up certain concerns as I went through the investigative process, oh, are you going to be one of those prosecutors? Are you going to be one of those people that's like looking for a reason to file charges? And I'm like, no, I'm just asking questions, right? Like I'm looking at this the same way I would look at any other case or potential defendant brought before me.
Did you recommend any charges in cases that you investigated?
I did not, not because anything on my part. It's just that the investigation was not finished by the time I left the office. So I had requested certain things. I had noted in memos my concerns, but the case.
What were some of those concerns that you noted? And this comment about one of those people, what does that mean?
So with regards to the concerns that I noted, the particular case I was investigating, this was not the officer's first fatal shooting. He had several fatal shootings. I believe it was two. And again, don't quote me on this because of the fact that it's been some time since I looked at that file. But I believe he had two within a 6 month period of time. So that was something that was a huge flag to me because I know a great many number of officers never discharged their weapon in their entire careers. So to be able to have two in 6 months to me was a deeper problem. So I definitely flagged that for the next person because I was leaving the office and was no longer going to be a prosecutor.
Was this the only police involved shooting or police on duty shooting that you were involved with as a prosecutor?
I had a second one, but again, the same situation. Since I was leaving the office, I had to turn it over to someone else.
I understand. And then this comment that was made to you, one of those people, that was interpreted by you to mean what?
It was interpreted to me to mean that basically the policy, as this person sees it, was to basically not file these types of charges, to basically look for a reason to exonerate the officer rather than really do a thorough investigation. And if the chips fall where they may, if it ends up that charges are appropriate, then fine. But that was very jarring to me because I'm like, a prosecutor's job is to do justice.
Was it your sense that was a systemic belief within the SAO's office?
I believe there was a core number of people who worked on those cases that had that belief. I won't
And
say
are those
everyone.
People still working today, in your knowledge?
Some are.
And should you win election, presumably you would become their boss.
Absolutely.
How would you return to that office as the top prosecutor if you win election and deal with that sentiment, to put it mildly?
So first off, I believe in communication. So I will set forth what my standards are, what the new policies and procedures would be when it comes to these cases, that we're going to be addressing them aggressively. And also, we won't have the same situation with so many people being involved in police shooting duty and only being able to work on certain parts of it while they're handling other cases. By having dedicated prosecutors that work solely on that issue, that minimizes the various viewpoints of, what people think that the job should be about, right? So I think that will handle some of that issue. But at the end of the day, it's about setting forth clear guidelines and clear expectations so that if people fall short, then you can pursue the disciplinary process as necessary. But if people don't understand what's expected of them or how they, what sorts of outcomes are expected from them, you can't then turn around and fault them when they don't do what's expected.
We're speaking with Melba Pearson, a candidate for Miami-Dade County State Attorney. To your phone calls, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. That's our telephone number. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. It was a week ago here on the South Florida Roundup that we spoke with the current state attorney in Miami-Dade County, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. She's running for re-election. And I asked her about her record in bringing charges in police on-duty shootings. In the 27 years, the critics will say that you've brought charges twice. One was a retrial, as you mentioned, early in your career. And the second was the most recent one with the North Miami police officer involved in that non-fatal shooting. Yes. The others hadn't been brought forth for charges.
Right, for the reasons I just told you.
Right.
And for the levels of scrutiny that they've been through. Remember, there's a recommendation by FDLE. There's a review by the lawyers. There's a review by the committee. And then every single one of those cases is sent to the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division.
So, Melba, presumably you would be subject to that same level of scrutiny and oversight. Wouldn't you have that same review process to investigate police on-duty shootings?
Similar, but not the same. So while some of those cases can go to the Department of Justice, that does not change what happens in state criminal court. You can still move forward and then just work with the Department of Justice with regards to them scheduling any trials or charges or anything that they're working on. So that does not, that should not extend the time frame required to be able to look into these cases. And secondly, there shouldn't be so many committees involved. Again, by having those dedicated prosecutors working solely on those cases, then they're able to work more expeditiously and get things filed or resolved, because sometimes things won't be filed, cases won't be filed, but more able to do that in an expeditious manner. And also they'll be working more directly with FDLE so they can get information much quicker and stay on top of making sure that all the requisite evidence gets in a timely manner.
So what review committee would you eliminate if you are Miami-Dade County State Attorney?
There shouldn't be any review committees internally other than just checking with the prosecutors to make sure that they have all the resources they need and make sure they're not hitting any roadblocks. But there shouldn't be this whole other extra process. It's a matter of if you hire a prosecutor, you train them and teach them what's expected, then you should be able to be comfortable in their decision-making process, in the way they put cases together. These are going to be more senior prosecutors, so they will have done homicide cases and other complex cases before. So I should be able to trust their judgment in moving forward.
And would you commit to following your prosecutor recommendation, regardless of what that may be?
Sure. I mean, if as long as they did everything correctly, they sourced out all the evidence that's available, they turned over every rock to make sure that they understood the protocols involved and got every video that is out there, depending if that's the issue in the case. And if they did everything they're supposed to do, then there should not be a reason to follow their recommendation. And this is not, I'm not going to sit here on the campaign trail and say, oh, every police shooting that comes in is going to end up resulting in criminal charges, because that would be irresponsible to say. But if there is evidence, we're not going to turn a blind eye to it. And we're going to make sure that the community knows that we take these cases seriously and that we are about pursuing justice for everyone, whether you wear a badge, whether no matter your complexion or what part of town you live in.
800-743-9576, our phone number if you'd like to speak to one of the candidates for Miami-Dade County State Attorney. Melba Pearson is our guest here on this Friday. A week ago, we spoke with the incumbent who's running for re-election, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. Melba Pearson is a former prosecutor in the Miami-Dade County State's Attorney's Office and former official with the Miami ACLU. 800-743-9576. Melba, I asked Rundle about legal challenges in police officer shooting investigations and cases. Here's what she told us last Friday on the roundup. Are you advocating perhaps a review of even that legal language that that an officer could be justified in using lethal force if they reasonably believe that they are in fear or fear for public harm? That reasonable standard needs to be revisited?
I think that is something to review. I don't know where we land on it, but I think we have to have that discussion.
Melba, what do you feel about this standard reasonable standard to be met for a police officer in fear of their life or for public safety when it's involving a on-duty shooting?
So I have concerns about the reasonable standard, because, again, we don't want to have a situation where people are too, or officers are too quick to use deadly force, right? We really want to move towards using de-escalation techniques, and that deadly force ends up being a last resort, not a first resort. And I think there's a number of different ways to accomplish that, including better training, better de-escalation training, more contact with the community in non-stressful situations, making sure that we're funding social services so that officers don't have to respond to the same huge volume of calls and just be more focused on those that are more violent in nature. So I think there's a number of different things we need to look at and restructure when it comes to policing in America, because very clearly, you know, the people are very concerned. We see that in national protests, mm-hmm. as well as a long series of protests here in Miami-Dade County as well. So it is time to really review everything we've been doing with regards to policing and look for ways to do it better, because we are evolving as a country. We're evolving in the criminal justice system. So every aspect of the system needs to evolve as well. And that includes policing.
One of the tangible changes in training that's happened just this week in Miami-Dade police and Hialeah police, that they banned the use of this applied carotid triangular restraint, the so-called chokehold, although some debate or argument whether or not it's an actual chokehold or not versus just a sleeper hold, so to speak. But that aside, Melba, do you support this decision?
Absolutely, 110%. Because again, these are actions that are highly likely to result in death if applied improperly or if applied for too long. So we really need to move away from these sorts of tactics and focus more on training and de-escalation rather than, you know, getting to the point where we have these horrible violent interactions that end badly.
Melba, we have a caller talking about training here as well. Richard in Miami joins us on line two. Go ahead, Richard. You're on the radio.
Yes, hi, thanks. I just wanted to point out, because I think sometimes maybe the public isn't aware, that there is huge differences between cities in the U.S. of how police are trained and how police are vetted. I spend about half my time in Miami and in San Francisco, and have for many years, and the police there are so much better trained and vetted, and you really see it on the street in major ways. So I just want to bring that up in light of people's concern with changing.
I appreciate that perspective, Richard. Thanks for joining us here on the Roundup, the South Florida Roundup here. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Speaking with Melba Pearson, a candidate for Miami State Attorney, top prosecutor in the biggest county in the state of Florida. Melba, let's talk about another policy that critics have pointed to that is a hurdle for charges in police-involved shootings or violence, qualified immunity. It protects police and prosecutors, government officials of all stripes, from damages for violating someone's constitutional rights. Should the principle or specific policy of qualified immunity in Florida be revisited?
I think it needs to be revisited. I don't see any harm in revisiting all of our policies on a regular basis, because if there's ways we could be doing things better, if there's ways we could be more responsive to the community, then we should take a look at it. Now, with regards to, officers now having to face personal financial responsibility when it comes to using force, you know, again, I mean, we have a situation where we put a numerical value on people's lives, which is, you know, I'd rather have the point where we're not even dealing with these types of deaths, right? I mean, that's the point that we need to get to, mm-hmm. to make sure that people are not unnecessarily dying from an interaction with police. So whatever means we need to use to get there, I'm in support of.
You began our conversation talking about civilian oversight and an oversight board that you would like to see in place in Miami-Dade. There's a new push to revisit this issue on the part of the county commission. What's the makeup of that board that you would advocate for, as critics have looked at these oversight boards as sometimes institutionally captured by law enforcement? So who would serve on this type of board if you would to advocate for it?
So I do advocate for it, and I would want to see a mixture of community-based folks, law enforcement, because, of course, we cannot leave them out of the discussion, but we have to have people from the community, everyday people who are not necessarily politically connected, not, you know, don't have a big money name or anything like that, just average people who can speak to their experience or can also just look at things from a common sense, neutral perspective, the same way that we look to juries to be a makeup and reflective of the communities that the defendant is from. We would be looking for community members who reflect the community that the police officer serve. So I definitely want to make sure that this is not super politicized where, it becomes like a political appointment and it'd be very difficult for average people to be able to serve and give their perspective.
Let me get your quick thought here in our final minute, Melba, on this conversation now regarding defunding law enforcement. How do you hear that? What part of that, if any, do you support?
So when you actually dissect the concept of defunding police, it's not necessarily about abolishing police. For some people, maybe it is, but I think the greater discussion is about how we fund social services. And this is something I've been saying for decades, ever since I was a baby prosecutor. And every time there was budget cuts, we ended up losing great rehabilitative programs that we could refer defendants to so that they can get their lives back on track. Every time we hit a budget crunch and we cut from social services, we are cutting away from the community. So we've got to put that money back. I don't know if it necessarily needs to come from the police budget, but it needs to come from somewhere. So we need to reevaluate what we are prioritizing. Are we prioritizing safety? Are we prioritizing restoration and rehabilitation? Or are we just going to keep doing what we're doing, which is clearly not working? So to me, we need to really beef up the money we're putting into social services, social workers, counselors for schools, that sort of thing, because that prevents these kind of issues rather than trying to use a cure that is very painful.
Melba, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing it with us on the South Florida Roundup.
Thanks again for having me.
Melba Pearson is a candidate for Miami-Dade County State Attorney. Still to come, lots more talk here. Advocates calling for the defunding of police departments, what that means, and more of your thoughts on how you're hearing those calls as the Roundup continues. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for joining us. More protests are expected to happen across South Florida this weekend. Activists are trying to figure out how to establish lasting police reform. One proposal that's been gaining traction across the country is defunding of police departments. The Black Lives Matter Alliance Broward is asking the Fort Lauderdale City Commission to vote on a proposal. It would take away $10 million from the city's police budget. Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trentalis talked about the issue on Sundial this week.
Anyone who calls for the dismantling of the police department is not seeking reform. They're seeking revenge. Let's be sensible about our choices and not throw out, catchy little phrases that we can chant during demonstrations. Let's talk about real change and real reform.
Fort Lauderdale Police has faced scrutiny recently during these demonstrations. There's a recent incident of a protester who was severely injured after an officer shot a rubber bullet at her. You can join our conversation. The phone lines are open right now here on the South Florida Roundup on this Friday afternoon. What do you think about the priorities of a police department? What should they be? We heard from some listeners this week.
My name's Emily. I'm from Coral Gables, Florida. I'm in favor of spending money on traditionally underfunded programs. This includes job programs for kids with disabilities, combating sea level rise, more for our educational system, more affordable housing, especially in South Florida, and funding for meals for people who are disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. We can fund all these things if we defund our overfunded police department.
We're taking your phone calls live on this Friday afternoon here on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN. That's our live telephone number, 800-743-9576. You could also send us a tweet at WLRN. Police union representative, join us in just a moment. Joining us now via FaceTime audio is Jasmine Rogers-Shaw. She's an organizer with Black Lives Matter Alliance Brower. Jasmine, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having us on. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
And I as well. Let's define the term first, and we have done this frequently, and I'm sure you're asked frequently, but the effort to defund the police. Tell us what that means.
So it's about a reallocation of resources, right? I heard someone yesterday say, if you look at someone's budget, you can see where their priorities lie. And in so many municipalities and states across the country, police are taking up a significant amount of budgets, of government budgets. So what we're calling for is a reinvestment of those monies, that the dollars, into social work, into domestic violence prevention, into responding to mental health in our communities, into curbing homelessness. Things that even before a pandemic were bad and need to be addressed, and now that we're in this moment, have highlighted just how much those services are under-resourced. So similar to what the caller said, Emily, about putting it into programs, that's what we're calling for. This equipment that is a danger to our community. Latoya Ratliff has a fractured skull because of a rubber bullet. How can we reinvest that directly into people?
So is the idea then to take current dollars away from police budgets, from municipal police budgets?
Yeah, it's a reinvestment. It's a reimagining of what we have right now and how we can reprioritize that money to be back into community and directly impact people and the services they need. And what we believe is that if we're able to do those things, then the interactions with police can look very different. The ways that we need police in our community can look very different.
Is there a role for law enforcement that remains in your imagination of a defund the police process?
I think that we all have a duty to each other and to the health of our country to reimagine what public safety looks like. From one state to another, different behaviors are criminalized. Different things are seen as legal or illegal. People are going to jail for driving on a suspended license. All of these different things. I think we need to reimagine what safety actually looks like for everyone as a part of this society.
It oftentimes is called public safety, as a matter of fact, Jasmine. That's a good point. Let me bring in Stedman Stahl into our conversation. Stedman is president of the South Florida Police Benevolent Association, a sergeant with the Miami-Dade County Police Department. Stedman, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting us have a voice in this conversation.
We all have voices in this conversation as residents and community members, certainly, and that's one of the purposes of WLRN is to hear from all different types of folks. And by the way, they can call in right now, as a matter of fact, on this Friday. 800-743-WLRN is the telephone number. Stedman, what do you hear and what do you make of the calls that Jasmine and others are talking about regarding defunding police departments or moving funds away from the current public safety departments into more social services?
The problem is I don't know what group to listen to. Throughout the country, we're seeing I hear what the young lady says in Broward that to move funds from the department and put it in other areas and other parts of the country is to do away with the police department altogether. There's a group called, I think, the Freedom Defenders, where they want to get away from jails. Just there should be no more jail system and stuff like that. So one, we have to find out. The one basic thing I think that everybody in our community wants is a safe environment. Throughout the years, and let me stay here more in Miami-Dade County where I represent, and what we've done is we've been taking a very proactive with the community. Part of our going, bringing community leaders into our academy classes with the officers to bridge those gaps. And I think we've done a great job here. But throughout, maybe we should become a little bit of a role model throughout the country. Are we there yet? No, we still have ways to go. But to take away funds from the police department, who do you think is going to suffer on that? When we have July 4th is coming up, and I'll promise you, you'll see a press conference where they'll ask the police officers to stand out there to denounce the guns being shot into the air, to do more enforcement in the neighborhoods. Where do we go to? We've become, Miami-Dade County Corrections is the largest psychiatric ward in the county. So this mental illness problems that we have out there.
Stedman, let me have Jasmine respond to that, because I think that's part of this conversation. And you're right, there's lots of different calls across the state, but let's focus here on South Florida. Jasmine, Stedman talks about, you know, those various roles that you've identified as well for law enforcement.
Right. And again, I want to emphasize the reimagining of public safety. Police haven't always existed in this country, and particularly not in the way that they are right now. So what we're calling for is it necessary to arrest someone for driving on a suspended license and put them in jail for not paying a fine? Is it necessary to lock folks up for marijuana charges, where in some parts of this country, you can start a thriving business based on that same marijuana? Is it necessary for us to have police engage as mental health counselors in school, as social workers, as like all these different roles?
Jasmine, I hear you. Those are criminal justice reform efforts, no doubt about it. But those are not at the police law enforcement budget level. Right. I mean, those are at really policy level and political leaders making those decisions.
Absolutely. And within that political system, there are police unions and police lobbyists that are advocating for and against certain things. And also, to be clear, none of these systems act on their own. They all interact with each other. Mm-hmm. So policing is just one system that contributes to all of the issues and all of the things that are being highlighted in the protests right now. So it's central to it, but there's still so much more.
Stedman, let me ask you, you've been on two police forces, I believe, Homestead and now Miami-Dade County, for 21 years, if my math is correct.
It's 31 years.
Sorry about that, Stedman. Have you experienced an expanded mission for police through those years?
Sure. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I started before Hurricane Andrew, and when Hurricane Andrew came in, that was all, obviously a game changer for our community down there. I still live in the South Dade community, and we changed our roles. The roles of the police officer, it seems that every time that something goes wrong, they want the police to come and fix it. I'll give you an example. Miami-Dade County had an election debacle years ago, and it was the call of the Miami-Dade Police Department to come in to take over the elections department. That's something that I don't know if that was our role, but the community leaders at that time put that in our control. We had an animal service problem where the police department had to come in and take over the stray pets of this county because there was a breakdown. So to go back on, should we arrest everybody? If I could just answer a question of the suspended license or marijuana, those are laws that need to be changed. If that's the laws, as police officers, we're out there enforcing the laws. If we don't like those laws, then we need to change them, just like the marijuana. We do not arrest for marijuana anymore in this county or in the state right now. And if that's what
for smaller amounts,
people, for smaller
amounts, right.
But,
okay.
But that's the will of the people. Yeah. That's the will. But that's the change. But the police officers who are out there, you know, day in and day out, are here to protect the community, not to be an impediment to the community.
Stedman, stand by. Just hold the line. Stedman Stahl with us. He heads up the Police Benevolent Association for Miami-Dade Police. Jasmine Rogers Shaw is along with us as well. She is an organizer with Black Lives Matter Alliance Broward, talking about police and policing in South Florida. 800-743-WLRN. Community Voices on the phone number, 800-743-WLRN. In the Miami neighborhood of Edgewater, Richard is holding on. Go ahead, Richard. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. So I just wanted to address what Stedman said about how, you know, the Miami-Dade jail system is the largest psychiatric system and all that. And that is exactly what the problem is. Corrections officers and police officers are not trained psychiatric professionals. I mean, this is exactly what we mean when we say defund the police. We say that, listen, we want officers to work on crimes of violence. We want them to work on things that are truly hurting people. But they are not equipped to be, you know, psychiatric professionals. What we want to do is, when we say defund the police, we want to take some of the money that has been erroneously pushed to police budgets and bring it back to things like social safety net programs and getting these people the help. I mean, I can tell you myself personally, as somebody who has had a lot of experience with the justice system and incarceration, there's very, very little psychiatric assistance and treatment going on in a jail. And that's what we're talking about. You know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So when you give police, I mean, I believe it was the former chief of either Dallas or Houston who said, we're asking police to do too much. He said, we're asking police to be drug counselors, to be social workers, to be homeless shelters, to be all of these things, to be dog catchers. And unfortunately, we've made a mistake. We, as the community, our community leaders have made a mistake in saying, you know what, just let the police handle it, because we are now realizing that the police, who typically receive about 1,000 hours of academy training, are just not equipped to deal with these things. So,
Richard, I appreciate the ideas there. Thanks for sharing that perspective, Richard from Edgewater. Stedman Stahl, what do you hear there from Richard? Are police being asked to do too much? Are corrections officers being asked to be mental health counselors and unprepared to do so, in your estimation?
Yes, police officers have a very difficult job, and we have to come and let me deal with a domestic violence situation. We respond to a domestic violence situation, and we have to be within 5-10 minutes of arrival of a call, trying to fix a relationship that's probably been dysfunctional for years. Mental illness things. Right now, we only have two options right there to deal with the mentally ill right now. When we have people on the side, we call them homeless. A lot of them are mentally ill people that need medical help. And so when we respond to a call, we have a man that's naked on the side of the road, defecating on himself, that doesn't know what day it is. We have two options: arrest him or take him to the hospital. When you take him to a hospital and you get him Baker Acted, all they have to do in the hospital is stabilize him, give him some medication, get him so he knows what today is, and we let him out the door. That's all we do. In 1963, this country stopped the state hospital, mental hospitals, for good reason. Instead of fixing the problem, they stopped it. And what we do, we open the doors and let all these mentally ill people out there, and that's what we're being focused to address. So when somebody calls and we got a guy that's banging on cars on an intersection, the police are going to respond there, and we're going to have to make a determination: is that person mentally ill, is he on drugs, or is he just a bad guy trying to hurt people? We have seconds to make that decision.
Let me get Jasmine back into the conversation here, Jasmine. The sergeant, Stedman Stahl, they're talking about the police having to insert themselves into domestic violence situations, as counselors, as medical health evaluators, making those kind of quick decisions. How would your group, what's your group advocating to change that, to make those kinds of reforms that you're looking for?
Well, first, I want to appreciate the sergeant for affirming our point that police are tasked with doing way too much, and it's being lumped under public safety when it should be someone else that is responding to a mentally ill person. The only two options that we should have for someone that doesn't have a home, that may be defecating on themselves, should not be just arrest or going to a hospital. So this is exactly what we're calling for, is how can we reinvest resources to actually make sure people have the services that they need instead of just those two options. I know for me, a personal story is that I called the police for an accident I had several years ago. And I called the non-emergency number and begged them to send a public service aide. I did not want an officer to show up. Two officers showed up in two separate cars. When I got out of my car to talk to the officer about the accident, he put his hand on his gun and yelled at me. So how can we reimagine that role to be more community focused? I heard a sheriff's officer the other day said there's too many officers that are trained to be warriors. And more often than not, we just need to be community minded. We need to be in partnership and in coalition with community. Not every situation that we go into requires a warrior with their hands on their gun.
Jasmine, let me bring in another caller, Elizabeth in Hollywood. Elizabeth, thank you for calling WLRN. You're on the radio.
Thank you for the opportunity to give this point of view. I am really concerned about this calling for defunding of the police department, especially at this time. I think it's insensitive and it's foolishness. We are right before an election that's going to be a very difficult election. There are so many things about the administration trying to hold power as it is, and we know that that's probably not a good thing, that I think this will alienate a lot of people if this is held too hard at this time. And I want to just add, I come from an interracial family, and I'm white, but I've experienced police aggressiveness in an inappropriate way. I don't think it's just the color of your skin. I think that if you're not driving a Mercedes, that can happen as well. But I think that it's foolishness to take this hard stand when so many people appreciate the police, and there are legislative ways to deal with this issue after the election. And I think it would be more effective and a better outcome.
Elizabeth, thank you for adding your perspective there. Jasmine, how do you respond to Elizabeth and her concerns about the timing of calls for defunding?
I think this is the perfect time, because this is the perfect time for us to analyze candidates and their priorities and see where their head is at around resources and what is possible moving forward into 2020. There's a lot that's at stake. And I hear Elizabeth saying that it's not just about the color of your skin. No one is saying that only Black people are getting pulled over. But what we do know and what the facts show us is that in so many police departments and sheriff's offices across the country, Black people are being disproportionately arrested and incarcerated for some of the same crimes that white people are committed. We know that as a fact. So we can't deny those things. In 2015, Miami-Dade and Broward County were number one in the country for the shooting of unarmed Black people by police. Hialeah led the nation per capita in that. We know that there's something to be said about those hard facts, those hard numbers. That's not saying it's only Black people, but also, like, what is going on within our police departments that's leading to things like that?
This week, the Miami-Dade County Police Department and the Hialeah Police Department both banned the use of the applied carotid triangular restraint, the sleeper hold, sometimes mistakenly called the choke hold. Sergeant Stahl, do you support that decision?
That was a technique that's been used, but here that's a great example of us evolving to something different. I think last year we had over 640,000 encounters with the public. Of that, 280 of those encounters, 640,280 encountered some kind of a use of force. Of that, it was only used 20 times. With the use of the tasers now,
but do you support it being banned now outright, like it was this week?
It's if it's not needed, if it's a technique, we supported it. I mean, that's going to be the will. It's just going to. I think it's going to be. It's a lot of it's been banned throughout the country already through many departments.
Right, so, but this week specifically, it was the department that you work for that banned the practice. You can no longer use it as an officer in Miami-Dade County.
That's fine. You could use it in a deadly force situation if it's this, you were dying or that, but I mean, not as a general technique or a holding technique or a non-lethal technique.
We've got to leave the conversation here, folks. Lots more to talk about, and I do appreciate the time of both of our guests as well as lots of callers. We're going to continue to have this conversation. Difficult as it may be and sometimes, but as important as it is all the time here on WLRN. Sergeant Stedman Stahl has been with us. He is the head of the Police Benevolent Association for South Florida. That's the Miami-Dade County Police Union. Sergeant Stahl, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having us.
And Jasmine Rogers Shaw has been with us as well, the organizer with Black Lives Matter Alliance in Broward County. Jasmine, thank you for sharing your perspective and your thoughts as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this space. Have a good day.
Of course. Both of you have a great and safe weekend. We got lots more to come here. The coronavirus pandemic, it is still ongoing. We are going to take a look back at how local officials handled the response to the virus as it was coming into the Sunshine State. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public radio. Florida continues reopening. It's been about 3 months now since the state closed the economy to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Back in early March, just before local businesses began closing, the state had 26 reported cases of the virus. The majority of them came from here in South Florida. That prompted state and local officials to figure out how to respond to the unprecedented challenge brought on by COVID-19. WLRN's Katie Switalski dove into this response for a new upcoming episode of Reveal. That episode compares the responses early on in California and the responses early on here in Florida. The program premieres on WLRN Radio Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. You can also listen anytime at WLRN.org or, of course, wherever you happen to get your podcasts. Katie joins us now for a bit of a preview here on FaceTime Audio. Katie, always great to have you. Thanks for sharing some of the reporting.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
So no spoilers here as everything kind of continues to wind its way through. But generally speaking, a bit of a haphazard approach early on in March as federal, state, and local officials were getting their arms and brains around the threat presented by COVID-19. You essentially put together this timeline of Florida's response starting in March. What were some of the key moments that occurred to you?
Our primary objective was to look at, you know, how the early decisions, how they got made and who made them, are going to impact us going forward in this pandemic. And I will say it was really strange to talk to people and ask them to reflect on what they wish they would have done differently or what they felt went right, as we're still living in the middle of this pandemic. So some of those key moments, I really think we learned that people started staying home a lot earlier than they were told they had to, which is interesting. And another thing I would point out there on our timeline is just really kind of blew me away in the reporting process. The raw numbers that we're seeing really don't mean anything without the context. How much testing we're doing versus how many cases we've got, it all goes together. And so when you compare it to another state like California, they were the first in the country to shut down. And so they really paved the way for the rest of the U.S.
Yeah, definitely. The most populous state in the country was one of the first to put a stay-at-home order in place by the governor in California. In the meantime, Governor DeSantis here in Florida resisted those statewide calls for a good number of days, probably a little bit more than a week or so, even after, maybe a few weeks after California,
two weeks
after California put that in place. And instead, local officials kind of stepped into that void. And one of the focal points early on, and even this week, right, have been beaches. Closing beaches was the question 3 months ago. And then even over the last couple of weeks, it was, when will beaches reopen and what will the circumstances and the rules and the protocols be for folks who want to go to the beach? You spoke with the Fort Lauderdale city manager, Chris Lagerblum, about making the difficult decision about closing the beach back 3 months ago. Let's listen.
I think it was sort of perceived at the time as, why are you doing this and why so soon? And maybe now hindsight being 2020, we said, why didn't we do it a week sooner?
How much second-guessing did you hear from officials, even in, as they're still in the middle of responding to the public health emergency?
I think a lot of local officials were really upfront about the fact that they did what they could with the little information they had at the time. And a lot of it, as people are reflecting back on this, turns out to be gut. It's conversations they're having with other leaders. A lot of people, like Chris Lagerblum, were talking to West Coast city leaders and watching what was happening in California. And sort of getting the chance to ask them, what would you have done 2 weeks ago?
And if we think back only 3 months ago, when we learned, I think it was March 13th, when the local school districts began saying that they were closing for an extended spring break.
Yes.
It seemed quaint, seemed like a big decision at the time, frankly, to extend spring break by a week. And soon enough, the students were not going back to schools at all. That was a bit of a watershed moment, I think, for folks, Katie.
Absolutely. For South Florida, no doubt, because we led the rest of the state. I think the rest of the state was looking to the three largest school districts in the state to shut down. And that was a moment. But we also in the episode look at some other moments, including spring break and how that affected our region here.
Oh, yeah.
The election. Remember when we had an election?
The primary in March. That's right. March 17th was that election.
Absolutely. And we also look at how different cities and towns and then ultimately counties did patchwork rolls out of the stay at home or safer at home orders. So there's a lot of those decisions to look at.
Yeah. And what did you learn about coordination that was happening in real time? You mentioned the difficulty in just having a lack of data to make significant decisions back in March and April. But what about the coordination between officials? What have you learned about their willingness or even ability to be able to talk to one another and to understand what each community is doing? Because we did see a bit of a difference in responses and still continue to.
We do still continue to see that difference. I think it's pretty clear if you're looking at a timeline that officials really started to coordinate much more as the weeks went on. In the beginning, it was even more patchwork and piecemeal. There has been some learning about how to work together over time. For one example, when Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale Beach shut down, other coastal mayors were not told about that. And now in the reopening process, you see much more coordination.
And in that closing process, the state really hardly played a role until late in the day in April. Whereas here, is it arguable that the state is kind of leading the way in terms of reopening protocols?
Yes, but also looking at South Florida, we are still reopening more slowly than the rest of the state. So for people that have family and friends in other parts of Florida, you know, they don't have to wear masks to the grocery store, or they can, you know, they could eat out before we could. And I think people in South Florida are seeing, yes, a lot of things are reopening, but compared to other places, it's still going more slowly, which is hard to wrap your head around a little bit.
And I know you look back at these decisions. The officials you spoke to, how are they applying the lessons that they learned in March and April to decisions that will be coming up in June, July, August, September, and beyond?
I think the theme is people are just taking it a day at a time and looking at what, you know, one small action, how that's going to cascade into others and sort of watching those numbers. We've got more testing now. We've got some more data. It still doesn't mean much unless you put it into context, but there is more of it to go off of.
Yeah. Katie Swetolski, along with this, the WLRN Broward County reporter, who also reported extensively on the timeline for Florida and South Florida's response in the early days of COVID-19 for Reveal. It will be on your radio here on WLRN Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Katie, thanks for giving us a little preview here on the Roundup.
Thanks, Tom.
We will have Katie Swetolski, by the way, Monday morning at 9 on WLRN Connects, talking about milestone moments during the pandemic. You can join us then. The Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. The director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. Peter J. Meritz is our technical director and the radio operations director. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.